City Attorney at the lead counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Johan Conrad on behalf of the appellant, Virginia International Gateway. This is a tax case, as you know. There's real property and personal property issues. I'm going to first talk about the real property elements, and then I'm going to talk about the personal property elements. Also, at the beginning, I'd just like to mention I'm going to set aside 4 minutes for my rebuttal. First, with respect to the real property, there are essentially two issues, or actually three. One is what I'll call the licensure issue, which has to do with the application of the appraisal licensure statute. The second has to do with the issue that I'll call the STS Cranes issue, which is the fact that there is a portion of the real property that was never addressed in the judge's final order. And the last that I'm going to talk about under the real property is the remedy. What happens depending on the decision of this court on one of the first two. So the first thing I'm going to talk about under the real property is the licensure issue. And here, the bottom line is the trial court refused to credit the opinion of the expert appraiser used by Virginia International Gateway, because even though he was licensed in 2016, at the time that he completed and signed off on his appraisal report, and at the time he did that, trial was scheduled for 2016. Trial was subsequently continued to 2017. And so when the appraiser expert took the stand in 2017, he did not have a Virginia appraisal license. And while during trial, the trial court judge refused to bar his testimony and qualify him as an expert, after trial, the trial court reconsidered and in the final order and opinion determined that his opinion could not be credited because he was not licensed during relevant times related to the proceeding. Now, we believe that conclusion is wrong for two reasons. One is a general reason with respect to the application of the statute. The other is a more specific reason that applies to the specific factual circumstances of this particular case. So the general reason we think that the trial court is wrong is that he relied on what we believe is, and I think the record supports, is older and no longer valid precedent. And so this is covered extensively in the briefing, but just to set the table, if you will, prior to 1995, the appraisal licensure statute did not include language that it now includes, which says, nothing contained herein shall prescribe the power of a trial court judge to qualify an expert in any legal proceeding. That particular language is added in 1995. It's added around the same time that this court issued its Lee Gardens decision, which never mentions that particular language, I believe, because it was dealing with a decision to disqualify an expert based on the older language of the statute.
So you would accept in theory, though, that a trial court could take into account as a factor the failure to have a license at the time of testifying, or could, in theory, allow the expert to be qualified but find the testimony less credible because of that one factor, but can't use it as a sledgehammer to just keep the testimony completely unaddressed.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe, I guess you would argue, given whatever the circumstances were, how much that might impact it. But in theory, frankly, I think a trial court can consider all sorts of factors in determining the amount of weight to give a particular expert. But all of those factors are different than the question of whether or not to qualify the expert in the first place. And that goes back to the age-old question we have with experts, which is weight versus admissibility. And what the trial court did here was concluded that under the language of the statute that it was a bar to admissibility. And he would have, and in fact did, qualify the expert if the question was simply one of weight. In fact, he talks about that in his opinion and essentially says he was qualified. But he did use it, I think a sledgehammer is a good word, and also he he appeared to, and I frankly like Judge Hawks very much, but he, in his final order, he said both, I think I have the power to qualify him, and then he said in the sort of next breath, but I can't qualify him because doing so would be to essentially condone an illegal act. Now, that's a segue to the second problem that we have with this particular ruling, which I said a second ago was going to be the specific part of it. Even if you took the statute and interpreted it the way that Judge Hawks interpreted it, there was no illegal act here, because when the appraisal report was completed and signed by the expert, he was in fact licensed in Virginia. The report was issued and signed in 2016 at the time that the expert was licensed in Virginia. When he testified in 2017, he was testifying about the conclusions contained in that report and the issues that arose surrounding that particular appraisal report. So even if this court disagreed with our position and said, well, you know, we do think that the statute has a more strict application and we sort of agree in general terms with the way Judge Hawks looked at it, the fact is, under these circumstances, the actual appraisal report was completed and signed at the time, and the opinion was given at the time that he was an expert. So the fact that he was testifying, showing up in court and testifying about a 2016 appraisal report, did not, under the language of the statute, mean that he was engaging in any sort of illegal activity. In fact, if you look in the appendix, and in fact it's in the sealed portion, which I believe is volume 6, you will see that during the expert's opinion, the parts of his report were introduced into evidence as the basis for his testimony. That opinion that was introduced into evidence, which I believe is Plaintiff's Exhibit 36 and selections from that, were all portions of his report that was completed and signed in 2016 when he was licensed. And so even if you step back from the general issue, specifically the way that it was applied in this particular case was an error. Now, one other thing I want to say just with respect to this issue before I move on to the other parts of the real property argument is that in the sequence of events and the reliance of circuit courts on the amendment of the statute, I think, is important. So in 1995, the statute's amended to add this language saying that that nothing herein shall prescribe the powers of a judge to qualify an expert. At that time, the statute said, this is declarative of existing law. So in 1997, there were some more decisions by some circuit court judges. And one of the things that they relied on is they said, look, at the time that this statute was amended in 1995, it said it's declarative of existing law. Existing law in 1995 included a 1993 Attorney General opinion that said unlicensed appraisers cannot testify as experts. And so in 1997, the Circuit Court opinion said, well, since it said it was declarative of existing law, it must have known about the 1993 Attorney General opinion, it must have taken that account, and it did not intend to reverse that. Well, in 1999...
Counsel, I'm going to have to stop right there. As someone who, on a few occasions,
I am well aware of
declarative of existing law to legislation, and ironically also signed a few Attorney General's opinions, I never knew the opinion of an Attorney General to be the law.
Your Honor, I'm telling you...
Sometimes attorneys general can be wrong.
I don't disagree, Your Honor. I'm describing to you what the circuit court said. I've read
the opinions, and I chortled as I read them, just as I'm chortling now.
Yes, sir. And I frankly am not. I'm not taking issue with that. I think that's another reason that the circuit court judges were incorrect in 1997.
They were using the declarative provision of the amendment, sort of as a reverse play. The claim that it was actually always this way.
Yes. And it frankly seems in direct contradiction to what the amendment actually said. But then in 1999, to sort of remove any doubt, the General Assembly removed the language that said this is declarative of existing law, but of course left in the language that said that nothing in these appraisal licensure statute requirements should be read to prescribe the power of a judge to qualify an expert.
Very briefly, if you're right on this, that there was an error for the court to interpret the statute that way, the court shouldn't have blown off the entire expert opinion on this ground. I take it it would be a remand. I mean, there's nothing to be done on appeal on this point.
Well, that's an excellent question, Your Honor, and the and that segues into the remedy that I was going to talk about. And here, I believe there is precedent. We cite it in our briefs. I know there's precedent that there are property tax cases where the record is full before the court. There's no question here of, you know, how, do you believe the witness who said green or red? I mean, the record is the record.
We're talking about expert testimony, and with your experience, you know that that can be quite variable in terms of its credibility, no matter how credentialed the person might be.
I agree with that general proposition, Your Honor, and I do believe that in this particular case, the evidence of value that we put into the record is straightforward and could be a basis for this court to rule without remand.
But to rule just on that aspect of the real estate? I mean, you've also got the crane issue, which is entirely, even if your expert is allowed, his testimony comes in, you've still got that crane issue and the personal property, the STS crane issue and the personal property issue, which is perhaps not quite as strong an argument on your behalf.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with you that the personal property is a separate and distinct animal, if you will. The STS crane issue, again, the trial court judge didn't even look at the STS crane issue. He never mentioned it. We had, from the Netherlands...
But that's the point that Justice Moon is making. We can't decide this de novo on the facts, of course. If you carve off the personal property evaluations, the fact-finding, you basically go back on remand for assignments of error 1, 2, and 3, and you start from scratch, right?
I don't think we start from scratch. We have, Judge Hawks is still
on
hearing
real
cases.
Estate.
Excuse me?
On real estate, you start from scratch. You don't on personal property.
I believe that Judge Hawks could, having sat through this record for 9 days, could go back and look at an issue and opinion
without. I
apologize,
I overspoke. You don't have to introduce new evidence. You can just go through it. But he has to make those decisions as a fact finder.
Your Honor, our position here is that your court could make that decision given the record that's in play. I understand where you're coming from on all the circumstances, and I guess I would say our position is that this court could do that.
You're down to 2 minutes and 35 seconds. You may use your time as you wish, however.
I understand, Your Honor. For 30 seconds, I'll talk about the personal property issue, which is just to say that we had the leading expert in the world on marine container terminal equipment come in and analyze the cranes at issue and provide an opinion of value. And the trial court basically said, well, I'm going to agree with the city's expert who had never even seen a crane before the trial, and in fact told me, and this is in the record, at his deposition, that he'd never been on a marine container terminal and at one point had seen them on Long Island or Long Beach from a distance. And I believe we covered that in detail in our briefing. I'm going to reserve the 1 minute and 50 seconds I have for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew McRoberts. I'm here on behalf of the City of Portsmouth in the Virginia International Gateway versus City of Portsmouth case. Just to respond real briefly to my opposing counsel on the real estate, personal property, and the sort of remedy issues. On the real estate issue, there's no question that at key times involved in this case, the appraiser whose name was a Mr. Fandel. Mr. Fandel was unlicensed. He was unlicensed when he did his work initially in 2015. At that time, he was employed by the taxpayer as a tax consultant who was hired specifically to lobby the city and lower the taxes. At that time, he developed his opinion of value, and he developed something between 90 and 100% of his opinion of value, including his initial draft of the appraisal report. After that point in time, and that was unsuccessful, and there was a lawsuit, at that point, he was designated as an expert. He did, at that point,
become licensed in Virginia. However, all he did was take his already existing report and already existing opinion of value, which he had been used to lobby the city to lower the assessment, and said, that's my opinion.
The statute, the 1999 amendment, isn't it clear that the legislature is saying, look, judges, just use your typical qualification standards, but don't use the statute to drop people off the list, or for that matter, to add them onto the list. This is a statute dealing with a different problem. You guys do what you do in the courts, we'll do what we do with our regulation of regulated industries. Isn't that a fair assumption?
Well, about what I would agree with you in part and disagree with you in part. I agree that the intent of the language was to say, notwithstanding Lee Gardens and notwithstanding whatever else might have happened in the past, or notwithstanding the statute, trial courts have discretion to qualify experts.
Absolutely.
It doesn't cut them off.
That said that he's not going to qualify them. Because you know what? If you can't keep your darn license, your opinion must not be terribly qualified to be admitted in court. But that's not at all what he said. He used it as a bar. Am I right or am I...
No, he did not use it as a bar. He said, I could qualify him. But he said, I will not. He discretionarily...
Because he essentially did use it as a bar. He said, I could qualify you, but then I would be condoning illegal activity. And he specifically relied upon Lee Gardens and the two circuit court cases that were built upon the Lee Gardens Foundation, the one by Judge Smith in Washington County, the other one by Judge Ledbetter in, I think, Spotsylvania. Well, Lee Gardens was incorrectly decided. And you and I, as General Assembly veterans, could talk about it outside of court. I'm not going to waste your precious time here. Lee Gardens has no weight. It was incorrectly decided. It's part of an interesting aspect of history.
Okay.
Without Lee Gardens, without those two circuit cases, how could the judge possibly have said, this is illegal?
Because it was illegal. There's a statute that said what he did was illegal. He sat there and gave a verbal opinion, an appraisal opinion in court, without being licensed in Virginia.
But the 54.1, 2010, and 2011 read together in the year 2019 make it very clear that he had the discretion to qualify him.
And that's what the judge said.
And then, but then if he had the discretion to qualify him, how could it have been illegal to qualify him?
It was illegal not for him to qualify. The judge committed no crime. It was Mr. Fandel that committed the crime.
Well, why would the legislature say, we're granting you, trial judges, the power to put someone on the stand to commit a crime? Why would any legislation... Why would we interpret the legislation to do that?
Because there is a difference between whether an expert is qualified to testify and whether a crime has occurred. I think it is a factor that the courts can consider, and in this case he considered it and used his discretion to disqualify.
Questions you just had with Justice Mims. If in fact it's illegal for him to testify, the 1999 amendment basically said, the legislature is telling the courts, we're giving you the power to basically aid and abet a crime, which is sort of what this trial judge thought he might be doing. Why would the legislature do that? Why would we interpret a statute and an amendment to suppose that?
Well, in our view, the language that it is existing law, declarative existing law, meant that judges always had the ability to identify factors that led them to qualify or disqualify. And in this case, he said, there is a crime that I do not wish to condone. And I think it's also very important to...
I'll keep interrupting you. What was the crime? The crime was the man was testifying in court, and there's a statute that says that the courts have the power to allow that.
Well, it also, because his opinion of value was determined back in 2015 in the initial report when he was also unlicensed. And that's the problem. It's important to understand...
The fact that he adopted it, apparently, taking your view of the facts, in 2016 when he was licensed. He did the appraisal in 2016 when he was licensed.
All he did, and this is his own testimony in the transcript at pages 420 through 435, in the cross-examination was, all he did was I added boilerplate. I made the report court ready. That's all he did.
Could he not adopt his position from the time he was a paid tax appraisal until the time that he then was going to give his expert opinion? What would be wrong with him adopting the earlier 2015 opinion?
Well, what would be wrong is that when your license expires, then you're sitting on the stand and you're giving an opinion, which is a verbal appraisal under the statute.
Well, no, Your earlier argument, I thought, was because he did it in 2015, and I'm going to say adopted it in 2016, that was the problem because he actually did the work in 2015. I thought that was your argument.
Well, there's two opinions. I mean, there's two crimes that were committed, if you will. One was the development of the appraisal opinion and the draft appraisal report in 2015, where he got his opinion of value that he later on turned into added boilerplate and had a final report in 2016.
Why is that a crime?
What's that?
Why is that a crime?
Because the definition of appraisal in the statute says an analysis, opinion, or conclusion relating to the nature, quality, value, or utility of specified interests of real estate. An appraisal may be classified by subject matter, and it says it may be real estate or real property. And then it goes on and talks about more. In other words, any analysis, whether it's verbal or written, is in fact subject to the law. And I think it's very important to understand that this original prohibition against appraisers behaving in an illegal fashion as unlicensed is important. It's not just a technical blip in the law. The savings and loan crisis was driven in large part because appraisers had unreliable opinions that were being relied upon by the public, the banks, the courts, everybody. And so the General Assembly adopted a statute that said appraisers have to be licensed, and the appraisal board has to adopt regulations and licensure requirements, and they did. They said all appraisers have to be licensed and they have to be following USPAP, Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice. At this point, because Mr. Fandel was not an appraiser when he developed his original opinion of value, he didn't have to follow those rules. And when he sat on the stand, he didn't have to follow those rules. And so it's not just a technical violation. It's the fact that the General Assembly has expressed an intent that not only appraisers be licensed, but they then also have to follow those rules. And he wasn't subject to those rules.
What would be your position if, when he did the appraisal, he was licensed, takes 2 or 3, 4 years for trial to actually get before the court? Once they get before the court, he has retired, he is no longer licensed, but his appraisal was done when he was licensed. Would you say that he could not testify?
Well, to address your hypothetical, obviously it's up to the trial court in each case to determine in their discretion, subject to the abuse of discretion standard, as to whether or not that person should testify. Something like your hypothetical actually happened in the Keswick 2 case decided by the Virginia Supreme Court. In that case, an appraiser who was licensed prepared a report and disclosed an opinion while he was licensed, in fact testified in court the first time while he was licensed. Then this court reversed. It resulted in a second trial, Keswick 2, and at that point in time, the county objected and said, he's no longer licensed. Don't let him testify. And the court used their discretion, subject to the abuse of discretion, to say, I think he developed all of the opinions necessary while he was licensed and when he was subject to those standards. And so the trial court let it in.
Second part of the hypothetical. He develops his opinions while he's not licensed, as this gentleman apparently did. He gets his license. He looks back at his report and he goes, I think that's a good evaluation. It follows the UPAP guidelines. I'm going to now add the boilerplate and turn it into an appraisal.
Thanks to the magic of licensure.
What's wrong with that?
Well, and that's the facts of this case. It's
right.
Not a hypothetical.
And I'm asking you, what's wrong with that?
Okay. Well, what is wrong with that is he then was unlicensed when he came to court to testify.
But you just told me it would be okay if he was unlicensed when he came to court, as in Keswick 2.
All I'm saying is that trial court in that case used their discretion to do that. And that's all I'm arguing for, the plain meaning of the statute. The statute says that licensure is required when you give verbal opinions, written opinions, anything. He violated the law before 2016. He violated after 2016. And then when B was added, which said that nothing herein shall be prescribed,
I think, why don't you address the 99 Amendment? The 99 Amendment can't be interpreted as a legislative authority to courts to violate and aid and abet a crime. So doesn't that mean necessarily that any other interpretation would be absurd? But that when he takes the stand, and if the court otherwise finds him qualified despite that, he's not committing a crime. He's allowed to. take the stand.
I disagree. I think that just as Judge Ledbetter said in his opinion, there are ways the General Assembly could have done that. As a matter of fact, 2010 itself, which is the subject of discussion today, has a bunch of exemptions in it. In other words, you have to be licensed generally in 2011, but in 2010, Section 54.1, 2010, there are all these exemptions, including for real estate brokers and other people that give opinions of value in their jobs, but they are not appraisers and they don't hold themselves out. They could have added an exemption to saying experts who are testifying for compensation can be unlicensed. They could have said that. They did not. The other thing Judge Ledbetter said in his opinion is they could have removed the discretion of a trial court to qualify or not someone who's licensed or not. They didn't state anything about that either. And that being the case, the General Assembly's silence must be taken that the plain meaning of the statute applies. The statute says that licensure is required, here are the exemptions, and as for B just simply says what it says. Trial courts have discretion. All it says is trial courts have discretion, and it's reviewable upon an abuse of discretion standard. And as in Keswick, the trial court used their discretion to allow it in that case. And in this case,
well, if it's illegal,
they did not.
If it's illegal for the witness to take the stand, how can the trial court have discretion granted by the General Assembly to aid and abet an illegality, which is what this trial judge thought was happening?
They simply didn't address it. The General Assembly did not address it, leaving it to the discretion of the trial court. Our position is every trial court who considers the facts in this case would probably come to the same conclusion as Judge Hawks. As a matter of fact, we believe that most courts, just like Judge Ledbetter and then the judge in the other case that was cited in our brief, would come to the same conclusion. But that doesn't mean that all will. Under the example I gave in Keswick, Keswick 1, Keswick 2, there were good reasons to allow it in that case, because they said, hey, this is a continuing proceeding. It's a remand, and therefore it's essentially like the beginning of the trial, and this is day 6 of a 5-day trial.
But it's still a crime. Don't worry about it. Put him on the stand, swear him in, but he's still committing a criminal offense, but everyone's okay with that.
Well, that's what happened in Keswick 2. I mean, he was allowed to testify. And so,
counsel, would you move along?
Yes, sir.
All right. What else do you have?
Okay. I think that on the remand issue, there's just simply a whole lot of things that are not decided in this case. Obviously, we don't believe that a reversal on any point is justified, but even if it were, it should go back to Judge Hawks for an analysis of the rest of the case. We don't know, for example, would Mr. Fandel have been inadmissible for other reasons. We argued, and he never ruled, on whether or not there were substantial factual foundation errors that would go directly to his admissibility. There were certainly credibility issues that even the judge himself noted in his opinion, but he never got to credibility. Was it credibility sufficient for him to disregard it? Perhaps. We don't know. And so it has to go back. And as Virginia National Gateway said themselves, he just never got to certain parts about what the other personal property expert had said. And on the personal property, just as a conclusion, there's just a fundamental issue there, because the error says transportation costs should not be consideration for fair market value. The fact is the judge made that ruling, certainly, but he also made other rulings, including that the expert, whose name was Verheyen, was simply speculative and that he had no basis for his opinion. And so, and there was no error assigned to that. And so for those reasons, Justices and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, we ask that the opinion of Judge Hawks in its total be affirmed.
Counsel,
thank you very much.
Counsel, I'm going to have a few questions. They won't be too long. I did ask the permission of the Chief Justice to wait until the end of your argument so that I wasn't taking a big chunk of your time. But the fact that you're relying upon Judge Ledbetter's circuit court opinion and the declarative of existing law language really, I think, requires these questions. And as I mentioned, you and I have each spent a lot of time across the street. And this one really started to fascinate me as I read through it. So I want to go through a timeline.
Yes, sir.
And I'll go through the timeline, and then I want to get your response to it. 1993, the Attorney General opines that under the statute as it then existed, an expert cannot testify without a license.
And that's what the statute said at that time, too.
Yes, indeed. Then The General Assembly meets, and as you know, sometimes when the General Assembly meets, squirrely things happen. A bill goes in by Delegate DeBoer in 1995 that does not have the language that we're talking about now. But it does amend the proper sections. Goes through to the Senate General Laws Committee, and on February 17, 1995, the General Laws Committee adds the language that we've been discussing. It says that an expert can testify. And it says this is declarative of existing law. Now, when the General Assembly says that, it generally is speaking to a judge or an attorney general or someone to say, we think you're wrong. We want to make sure that we specifically say that this has already been the law, but now we're putting it into statute. Also, interestingly enough, the General Assembly doesn't usually put that provision into the code itself. As you know, it usually puts it into a second enactment clause so that it's part of the law, but it doesn't show up in the code. This time, it actually shows up in the code. And that occurred in 1995, and it became effective on July 1, 1995. The Lee Gardens appellant's brief was filed on July 7, 1995, 6 days after the law took effect. But it never mentions it. This would have been a winner for that attorney. So you wonder, why did that attorney not mention this particular statute? Well, the attorney was from Chevy Chase, Maryland. I'll just leave it at that. Arlington County's attorney, who certainly knew of the amendment, didn't mention it in his appellee's brief. You wouldn't have expected him to. And the General Assembly and the Supreme Court therefore decided Lee Gardens, probably without actually being aware of the new statute, because it had not been brought to the attention of the Supreme Court. Judge Ledbetter then relies upon Lee Gardens, as does Judge Smith in Washington County, to say no expert testimony. And I happen to think that was just wrong for the reasons I've stated. 1999 comes along, and Delegate Cranwell, probably the smartest member of the General Assembly, I just said that on the record, didn't I? Oh, well. Probably the smartest member, puts in a bill having really nothing to do with this particular issue and strikes through this is declarative of existing law. And you've got to wonder why. I speculate that perhaps it was simply legislative services saying you don't have to have, you're not supposed to put that provision into the code itself. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, it's put into a second enactment clause. So that's how I parse all of this. Tell me, if you will, where do you believe I'm wrong?
Well, I agree with you that Lee Gardens is different than this case, and it certainly doesn't guide or at least it doesn't control this result. In Lee Gardens, the holding of the trial court was that expert was ineligible to testify. Okay. Whereas Judge Hawks in this case said, I could qualify him, but I choose not to, which is a different ruling completely. And as a matter of fact, each time that Virginia National Gateway has framed it, they frame it a little more as a bar, as I think we've discussed, that a court could not qualify him. Well, Judge Hawks never said he could not qualify him. In fact, he said, I could qualify him, and I choose not to, not because the statute makes it a crime, but because I don't feel comfortable condoning a crime. It wasn't a bar. It wasn't an outright bar. It wasn't a bar at all. It was a factor that I believe that the trial court can and should consider in deciding whether to qualify. Okay, because so I don't believe that that language under B about nothing herein shall prescribe means anything other than the trial court has discretion.
Okay, and I respect that argument. Mm-hmm. But if that is indeed your argument, then Judge Ledbetter's decision and Lee Gardens and the declarative of existing law issue are completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. They should just be set aside entirely, because that argument that you're making is not founded upon Judge Ledbetter's opinion or Lee Gardens or the declarative of existing law statutory language. Do you agree?
Well, in my view, I don't think that the law has changed all that much in all of these things. I think that this is a little bit of a red herring in our view. Our view is you read the statute as it is, and it says it's illegal. It was illegal from the date that it was first adopted in 1992. It is illegal today for an appraiser to give an opinion of value verbally or in writing. And so it's always been illegal. At the same time, since 1992, but it's always been the discretion of the trial court to qualify or not. And so I agree. I think it was probably taken out because of surplusage and it wasn't needed.
All right, you have rebuttal.
Thank you.
I don't want to overextend my rebuttal dealing with the licensure issue too much. I just want to say a couple quick things about the opinion here. This is directly from Judge Hawk's opinion, which is page 2292 of the Joint Appendix. This court will follow and adopt the reasoning expressed by Judge Ledbetter and by Judge Smith. He then said in the next paragraph, it is of concern to the court that this is a harsh outcome, especially when one considers that experts are allowed to testify routinely in Virginia courts as to a vast array of issues without the necessity of obtaining a Virginia license, but the requirement of a Virginia license in real estate or property appraisals is clear and cannot be ignored. I don't think there's any doubt that, as Justice Kelsey said in the beginning, used it as a sledgehammer or a cudgel, and as
May
opposed
I ask you
to
this, in just a couple of sentences, what's the best argument you have that we should reverse the personal property fact-finding, which is fact-finding after Oritin as evidence? It's classic appellate deference.
So, first of all, the trial court's, the central part of the trial court's decision had to do with the fact that the property, in our expert opinion, could not be sold to a buyer in the location where it was and had to go somewhere else. And so there were sort of different tentacles of that. But the trial court made several errors, and all related to that central issue. One, he said, well, it's already sold twice, pursuant to a lease and sale transaction. Well, that wasn't actually correct. It didn't sell in either one of those. There was a lease, and then there was a stock purchase. In fact, all of the experts in the case said the stock purchase couldn't be used because it wasn't actually a property transaction. And yet, the trial court used that to say, well, I'm going to ignore the expert who said the property has to go somewhere else.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Call the next case.